Hello and welcome to The Ballpark, a podcast from the Phelan US Center here at the London School of Economics. I'm Chris Gilson, managing editor of the Phelan US Center's blog on US politics and policy, USAP. On March 5th, 16 US states and territories held primary elections to decide the 2024 Republican and Democratic presidential nominees, a day known as Super Tuesday. The day after Super Tuesday, I spoke to Professor Jason Casellas about the results, the primary race so far, and what the trends may mean for the general election in November. Jason Casellas is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Houston and is the John G. Winant Visiting Professor for American Government at Oxford University for 2023-24. His work specializes in American politics with specific research and teaching interests in Latino politics, legislative politics, and state and local politics. I'd just like to start by welcoming you to the ballpark this afternoon. It's great to have you here. So we're conducting this interview on March 6th, 2024, the day after Super Tuesday, the big primary elections in the U.S. for president. Now that the dust has started to settle on the Super Tuesday results, I really want to ask you to reflect on some of the larger trends that we've been seeing playing out in the presidential primary so far. Looking at the headline results that we've seen overnight, is there anything surprising here?
Right. I mean, so there's not too much that's surprising. We knew that Biden would win the Democratic or at least most Democratic primaries and Trump would win most Republican primaries. I suppose there was one bright light for Nikki Haley in winning the Vermont Republican primary. Of course, for November, that's probably very little to worry about for Trump, because certainly Trump, I don't think a Republican has won Vermont in recent memory. So Biden will most likely win Vermont anyway in November. And yet, on the Democratic side, you had President Biden lose American Samoa to a fellow called Jason. Jason is his first name. I already forgot his last name. So it's someone who no one knew actually until last night. And that's just a fluke. American Samoa doesn't have any electoral votes, so I don't think that's anything for the Biden team to worry about. But it's just it was just a surprise of last night.
Thank you. And what about when we start to stratify the electorate by different groups? Are there any particular groups that you think we are finding surprising results or unexpected results for Biden or Trump?
Right. I mean, I think one of the things about this this primary, unlike other primaries in recent memory, is that there was really no competition on either side. So turnout was much lower in most places than, for example, in 2016, 2008, when Obama-Hillary race was really, really contested until the very end. And so because turnout has been so low in a lot of these primary states, there's just not a lot in terms of predictive power of what's going to happen in November. There are some sort of signs that we can look at in terms of the fact that even though Biden is the incumbent president, that there are some cases in which there's some Democrats who are not totally happy with his candidacy. With in Michigan, for example, significant number of Democrats voting uncommitted, or in other places with Marion Williamson or Dean Phillips, who are the opponents, getting some percentage of the votes. But obviously, Biden is the incumbent president, has done very well in the Democratic primary. So these are low turnout primaries with with committed Democrats who are going to turn out to vote in support of their nominee. And so this is not a big surprise. On the Republican side, Donald Trump, of course, had Nikki Haley as his main opponent. And Nikki Haley, overperformed in some places, like I mentioned, with Vermont, and doing quite well even in her home state. But not winning her home state of South Carolina was, I think, a really death knell really to her campaign. And she just suspended her campaign earlier today as a result of last night. And she stopped short of endorsing the president, former President Trump. So we'll have to see whether those Nikki Haley voters will come over to Trump at the end. Many of these people, I think, were people who would have voted for or certainly voted for Biden in the last election and are not sort of people who voted for Trump in the past and will vote for Trump in the future. So we'll have to see what Nikki Haley does, whether she will in the end endorse Trump. Right now, she hasn't. So we'll have to see how that unfolds.
Looking back on how we've gotten to this point, could you talk a bit about why there's not really been a credible or a successful primary challenge mounted against either Trump or Biden, despite there being a great deal of concerns from some quarters over their age, electability, and what looks to be a really deep unpopularity among a lot of voters?
Right. And I think it gets back to my earlier point about the primaries, and you have such a small proportion of voters, you know, the very committed party activists voting on both sides. And Biden has sort of, you know, governed as a progressive in many ways. And so many progressives who I think were initially reluctant to support him 4 years ago, you know, have continued and have been satisfied with his performance and are satisfied with Kamala Harris for the most part as his vice president, who's been very actively, you know, championing causes that the left of the Democratic Party are really, it's really important for them. But, you know, the majority of voters, right, see both candidates as deeply flawed. Obviously, the age is the big issue, which seems to affect Biden more than Trump, even though Trump is only a few years younger than Biden. And so, obviously, the age issue is the one that Dean Phillips, the Minnesota congressman who was running against Biden in the Democratic primary, he really pushed this issue as his main issue, that age was a concern. It just did not seem to resonate with most Democratic primary voters. And whenever you're the incumbent president, it's very difficult for any kind of challenger, and this is regardless of age, as we've come to see with Biden, it's very difficult for an incumbent president to not win renomination if he desires it. And so that's the key explanation with President Biden. Donald Trump is kind of like an incumbent. You know, it's sort of very, very unique situation where, you know, the last incumbent Republican to lose his reelection, you know, chose not to run in the future. That was George Bush, the father. But Trump, of course, claimed that the election in 2020 was stolen from him, and a majority of Republican voters agree with him. And it's something that that he's used in his campaign, and many of these voters have stuck with him, you know, in this quest, right, to regain the presidency that was stolen from him, basically, right? And so they have this sort of revenge kind of theme. And that's compelling for a lot of the hardcore Republican primary voters. And so anyone not on board with that, like Nikki Haley, right, did not get the support of those hardcore Republicans who have been with Trump through thick and thin. And so Nikki Haley was the obvious alternative, and she ran a campaign basically saying that Trump, through his many, legal issues and also the January 6th, and you know, that's another legal problem, that it would be a distraction and that Republicans should nominate her because she could give policies that Republicans want without the baggage of Trump. While that may be convincing to a lot of moderate independents, it didn't convince Republican primary voters, right? And they're the ones who make the decision. And so at the end of the day, then we're stuck with this rerun or this encore of the 2020 election. And we can talk about sort of the different dynamics in 2024 than 2020, even though they're the same candidates, because there are a lot of new issues that have emerged.
Thank you. You've talked a little bit about this, but I'd like to pick up a little bit more if we can. So on the Republican side, we have challengers like Nikki Haley, who you've mentioned, and Ron DeSantis, who've been unsuccessful. And actually, in Ron DeSantis's case, he's been out of the race for a few months now. Is this something specific to their campaigns? Were they bad candidates? Did they campaign badly? Or is it more indicative of what could be a structural shift in the Republican Party?
You know, I think, you know, the Republican Party is now, it's sort of the Trump Party. And, you know, Trump has sort of won control of the Republican Party. And you see this in elected officials all across the country who may in the past have been skeptical of Trump, or even, you know, in the case of Texas Senator Ted Cruz, ran against him in 2016. And, you know, and there was a very acrimonious campaign, but eventually endorsed Trump and has continued to endorse him. And so what we see then is Republicans kind of joining the Trump train, and it's this train that if one is not on board with the Trump train, then they're rhinos, as they're called, Republicans in name only, right? And there's been a big effort to try to purge the party of those so-called rhinos, and this is something that's happening in the state level, and that you see in a lot of down ballot primaries. In places like Texas, which is a place, Governor Abbott, the Republican governor, who initially when he was elected was certainly not a Trumpian, I guess would be the word, but someone who eventually became very like Trump in his policies, and especially on immigration and the border. And he has endorsed Trump heartily, and he's even being talked about as a potential vice presidential nominee. And so I think we've seen this shift of many Republicans who maybe at first were skeptical of Trump, but have kind of come on board with him. And so that's where the party is. And if any Republican runs who's critical of Trump, they're not going to be successful in any Republican primary. They're going to be soon kind of driven out of the party. And that's just seems to be the situation that we're in. In most states, Vermont accepted, right? But in most states, that's what the Republican Party is. It's Trump's party now.
Thank you. So, talking about Vermont, actually, and Nikki Haley. Nikki Haley won Vermont, although has now exited the Republican primary. Should we be surprised that Nikki Haley hung on for as long as she did as a candidate following her loss to Trump in her own home state of South Carolina a few weeks ago?
Right. That's a good question. And I think, you know, she promised to stay in the race. And I mean, her hope was that despite the loss in South Carolina, that Republican voters in at least some of those states, I mean, she campaigned in some states, especially those states with a Republican electorate of more college educated Republicans, because generally what we see is that the Trump coalition, and this is something that it's kind of new. I mean, you know, the Republican coalition has not traditionally been that of working class people. And what we're seeing is a shift of working class voters of all races, actually, to Trump and the Republicans. And this is a new phenomenon. You know, the Democrats have always traditionally been the party of the working class, and have really tried to make that their claim, and Republicans have sort of chipped away at that, more especially with the white working class, as we see in places like Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, states that have become swing states. Michigan, Wisconsin were not swing states, but it's that white working class that I think that's made those states swing states. And in what I study, the Latino vote, you do see as well some shift to the Republicans with Latinos, not as drastic as the white working class, but significant nevertheless. And it's something that Democrats should pay attention to if they want to start sort of retaining what they have of the working class vote and stopping, as it were, the bleeding of working class people to the Republicans.
And that's a great segue to, I've got a few couple of questions on the Democrats and the Democratic Party. In states like Minnesota and Michigan and North Carolina, we've seen what appears to be quite a large share of uncommitted votes in the Democratic primary. Is this indicative of anything?
Well, I mean, I think there is a sense in which Biden is seen as too old. I mean, certainly his approval ratings are not very good. I mean, the last president with these numbers, these low numbers of approval rating, was Jimmy Carter, who of course did not win re-election, you know, in 1980. And so obviously the Biden team should be concerned about it. I'm sure they are. They wouldn't admit it publicly, but should be concerned about this, because one of the things that Biden is getting little credit for is the economy, and certainly in the U.S. as opposed to the U.K., you know, inflation has sort of been it's been more under control, and also unemployment has been fairly low, and the economy and the stock market seems to be picking up rather quickly, and the GDP growth is there in the United States in the last quarter. You know, the U.S. is not in a recession as the U.K. is now. And so Biden should be getting credit for this, right? But he's not. And I think part of it is Trump can make an argument that's compelling to, I think, a lot of working class people, saying, look, when I was president, a gallon of milk was $2.50 and now it's $3.50. You know, a loaf of bread was $2, now it's $3. And you could talk about details about, well, that's because inflation went spiked up immediately after COVID with, you know, with the economy reopening, and now it's under control. So now we're kind of, you know, have the brakes on it. But it's a tougher argument, I think, for Biden and his economic team to make, especially to people who, you know, live paycheck to paycheck, right? And where, you know, grocery and gas and those kinds of more immediate bills are more noticeable, I think.
Would you say that Democrats have an enthusiasm problem, or is it a bit deeper in terms of things you've already outlined?
Yeah, good question. I mean, I think it is deeper. I think the enthusiasm for Biden can be a problem because, like with any candidate, Biden was never the candidate that really inspired many sort of rank and file Democrats. He was sort of the consensus candidate back in 2020, and we need to sort of you know, defeat Trump, and Biden would be the most likely candidate to do that. And there was a sense in which he was sort of more electable than some of the opponents like Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren, others like that. And Biden, of course, by picking Kamala Harris as his vice president, the hope was that he could appeal to African Americans, right, as the first black woman as vice president. And without the African American vote and strong support from the African American Americans, it's very difficult for Democrats, right, to win nationwide. And I think that's going to be a challenge, getting Democrats, rank and file Democrats, black Democrats, excited to vote. And partially they can do that by warning that Trump could be president again, and that's certainly one motivator. But that's not enough. I think they need to do more, right? Kind of say more clearly the accomplishments of the Biden administration in terms of, you know, the economy and sort of turning around the economy and any kind of issues that they think can appeal to their base, right? And so I think that's going to be their challenge, motivating the Democrats to want to come out and vote for Joe Biden. It's much more difficult than Obama. You know, Obama had that ability to inspire, especially with people of color, with African Americans, Latinos, and Joe Biden is not Barack Obama. And so it's going to be more difficult for him, I think, to get, especially as he ages as well, sort of that perception of him as being frail or not being sort of having the mental capacity to continue in his position. That's something Republicans are going to talk a lot about. And his challenge is to reassure voters that he's up to the job and can do it for four more years.
Thank you. And just my final question on the Democrats. I just really quickly want to focus down on a specific primary race, actually, for the California Senate. It seems to be quite a high-profile race to, I believe, to replace Dianne Feinstein's seat, to fill Dianne Feinstein's seat. So Adam Schiff was successful in the primary and got far more votes than Katie Porter and Barbara Lee. Why do you think Schiff was so successful?
Because I think Schiff was seen as someone who had the credentials as a loyal Democrat. You know, in the House, he was, during the Trump administration, very visible on national TV. I remember watching every Sunday show he would appear almost every Sunday, you know, with the impeachment trials of Donald Trump. And so he was someone, I think, who was very well known, obviously nationally, but especially in California. That I think helped him in terms of name recognition. You know, Porter and Lee, of course, split the very progressive wing vote. So I think by having both of them in the race, it diluted their vote so that Adam Schiff, who is the more, I wouldn't call him a centrist Democrat, but I would call him a more, probably not as progressive as Barbara Lee, that's for sure, or Katie Porter. And interestingly enough, because of California's rules, right, it's just the top two vote getters who meet in a runoff. And Adam Schiff was hoping that the Republican candidate would be the second one, because effectively California is a Democratic state, and you know, it'd be an easier campaign for him rather than an inter-party squabble, which would have been the case had Porter come in second in running against him. And so the Democratic Party, I think, is spared a little bit of internal divisions by nominating Schiff and the Republican coming in second.
Thank you. I'd just like to go back to something you mentioned earlier, which is this idea of Trump running as an incumbent or like an incumbent. And I've heard a lot of commentary recently talking about that. If you look at the kind of results of an incumbent, Biden, in many cases, Biden is gaining 80, 90, 95, 96% of the primary vote in some states. With Trump, he's doing very well, but he's gaining 60% in that kind of region. Does that make Trump a weak incumbent in quotation marks?
Right. I mean, I think so. I mean, Trump, you know, certainly has that kind of baggage, right? And unlike 2016 or 2020, either of those cases, you know, you have the whole January 6th issue, right, in 2021, and how that changed the minds of maybe some people who supported Trump in 2020 and possibly even 2016, who may be reluctant to do so again, given his behavior on January 6th and subsequent behavior as well, not to mention all of the litigation and the court cases and the civil cases, and we can go in the, you know, all the different indictments that he has. And so that's new, right? But at the end of the day, you know, it will be a binary choice, right, between Trump and Biden. And for most Americans, it's going to be a situation in which voters will vote for someone they don't like because they would, we'll vote for someone who they don't like because they don't like the other person even more, right? And so that's the question, right? I mean, how will those voters who are on the fence, who don't like either candidate, who are not convinced by Biden's presidency and don't feel better off? You know, Ronald Reagan and others had said that the question to ask, are you better off today than you were 4 years ago? You know, we don't hear that a lot anymore, but I still think that matters to some degree. And the answer to that question, however, I think varies, a great deal, because we don't have, like we used to, I think, voters see the economy in the same way, right? That it's very much colored by partisan lenses, right, for most people. For those in the middle, you know, those swing voters, which are fewer and fewer than there used to be, the economy, I think, will matter more. But, you know, those who are diehard Republican or diehard Democrats will see the economy through a very partisan lens, and rather than sort of looking at the economy through objective measures, right? And so I don't think the economy matters in the aggregate as much as it used to, but it may matter for some voters at the margins.
Jason Casellas is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Houston and is the John G. Winant Visiting Professor for American Government at Oxford University for 2023-24. To hear more about Jason Casellas' work on Latino politics in the U.S., you can listen to our interview with him in early April 2024. And that's it for this extra inning of the ballpark. Thanks so much to Professor Jason Casellas for joining us for this episode. Check out the show notes for this episode for more of the LSE Phelan U.S. Center's coverage of Super Tuesday and the 2024 presidential election, including the YouTube link for our event, Deja Vu All Over Again, Super Tuesday and the Race for the Presidency. For more information about the Phelan U.S. Center, you can go to www.lse.ac.uk/united-states. On Twitter and Instagram, we're at LSE_US, and on Facebook, we're LSE United States.
This extra inning was produced by Chris Gilson and Anderson Tan. Our theme tune is by Ranger and the Rearrangers, a Seattle-based gypsy jazz band. You can look them up at rangerswings.com. To listen to all our previous episodes, just enter LSE Ballpark into your search engine of choice. You'll find us. We're free to listen to, and like lots of other podcasts, we're ad-free. We'd love to hear what you think about the show. Please email us any feedback at uscenter@lse.ac.uk, or you can send us a tweet at lse_us. And please, tell your friends about us. If you like what you've heard, then please rate and review us via your podcast platform. It really helps other people find the show. The content and opinions expressed in this podcast do not reflect those of the Phelan US Center or the London School of Economics. Thanks for listening.